Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Very happy to be here, man.
Joining us today, once again, is one of our favorite guests, Milton Alamadi. Milton, you know from Black Star News and also the African History Club. Also of the new book, Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, which I read this week and really, really enjoyed. Milton Alamadi, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you. Thank you. Greetings to both of you, and thanks for having me again.
Thanks for joining us. I'm really so I was a media studies actual master student. That's where I came from. And I mean, this book is one that if I was teaching, which is why I went to school, I wanted to be a teacher. Like, this is what I would definitely assign to people, especially because the way you start with the New York Times. And, you know, after Trump won, we saw a lot of people, with good intentions wondering, how can I stay informed with the best news of the day? And right. A lot of those folks go to institutions like the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I think your book really shows kind of why you need to be wary about what those institutions are doing. So right. If you could just tell folks your history a couple of decades ago now with your master's thesis and looking into the New York Times archives.
Okay, very good. Well, first of all, I have to say I got to the New York Times archives accidentally. What was the main concern was, even growing up as a teenager, you know, born in Uganda, but I grew up, my teenage years were primarily in Tanzania, so I went to high school. And I used to read a lot. So I would go to the what's called the U.S. Information Services, which I, you know, suppose is one of their, recruitment arms of the government when it's overseas. Yeah, but as a kid, you know, nobody approached me. So I just read. And what bothered me was the depiction of Africans and people of African descent. Even as a 12, 13-year-old, I could see there was a different way they were characterized in media. So that bothered me. Obviously, I can't do anything about it. But actually, it motivated me. I started writing letters to the editor. And then when I went to Syracuse for my undergrad, I remember sitting in an English freshman class where the professor was reading passages from Heart of Darkness. And it was one of the ugliest characterizations of, you know, Africans, the environment, just everything. And yet, he was elated. So obviously the students responded positively as well. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was the only one uncomfortable in the class. But as a freshman, not many of us, definitely not me, are equipped to challenge a professor and say, listen, you're wrong for this and that specific reason. It wasn't until years later, when I was a graduate student at the School of Journalism at Columbia, that we get to write a master's thesis. So I said, you know what, this is an opportunity for me to critique, to research and critique the evolution of coverage of Africa in Western media. Hmm. And I started with the Times because the Times is a very rich archives. A paper was founded in 1851, I believe. So some of the earliest editorials about Africa date back to like 1877. So I would go to the library in those days and just look at the microfilm. Now you can just sit in front of a computer and, you know, call them all up. And I did the research. So, and obviously I could tell that the paper was part and parcel of the weapons used to colonize Africa. So the 1877 editorial that I encountered, for example, was calling on England to get on the continent and start acquiring colonies before Germany could do so. And there was a consistent pattern. First, there would be demonization. Demonization, and as you see, that's part of the title of the book, of course. And the demonization was always, went hand in hand in justifying conquest, colonization, subjugation, and exploitation. So that particular editorial, for example, starts off by saying, you know, Africans are to be pitied because they are sort of a mix between the ancient hippopotamus and the crocodile. And I have no idea what that means. But it's clear that they're not like the rest of, quote unquote, us human beings. And a European civilizing country could do that good work of civilizing the Africans and at the same time earn profit while doing it. And if you look at it throughout history, and obviously it's not confined to newspapers, it's books, you know, media generally, that has always been the pattern. And we can also critique contemporary era. So after I looked at the static editorials dating from 1877, 1890, into the 20th century during the era of colonial rule and then decolonization, I said, this is all good, but I need to breathe some life into this. So let me try to interview many of the former Times reporters that went to Africa when they started sending correspondence physically there. And I contacted the Times and I was told, and this is once again before the, you know, internet era, just Google up, I was told it would be very difficult to assemble all of them to get their information for you to contact them. And why don't you go and see what we have in the archives? And I don't believe that they were aware of what they had in the archives.
Right.
Because I don't believe I would have been allowed access. So I go there and then I start finding some of the most ugly correspondences exchanged between reporters that the Times sent to Africa and editors right here in New York City. And I combine that with the, you know, the more static research, and that breathes life into the material. And I'll just give you one example. In 1960, the New York Times sent a reporter named Homer Bigart, who was a renowned reporter, war correspondent. He already won the Pulitzer Prize twice when he had been with the Herald Tribune before he joined the Times. And then now I'm paraphrasing. And he writes to his editor here in New York, Emmanuel Friedman, the foreign editor, that I really cannot get enthusiastic about these so-called emerging republics. The leaders are crooks or mystics. Dr. Nkrumah, Ghana's first prime minister, who led the country to independence from Britain in 1957. He says he's a Henry Wallace in burnt cork. I prefer the primitive bush people because, after all, cannibalism may be the best antidote
Lord
to the population heaven. Explosion that everybody complained about. So I say to myself, well, maybe this is one deranged reporter. But then I go and I look at what was published at that same time in the Times, purporting to be, you know, articles. And there's a perfect correlation between what he expressed in the private correspondence and what was published in the New York Times, including concoctions. So, for example, one time he's complaining that he cannot find pygmies in the Congo, Belgian Congo, which was a transition to independence, to interview them of what independence meant. But by the time the article is published, he purports that to pygmies, independence means more beer, more salt, just, you know, demonizing the whole notion of independence for African country that had gone through this ugly colonial era. So then I put the paper together, and the paper is recognized at least by my peers and some faculty. It won one of the awards that they give at the end of the end of the year to students. And then I was approached by Columbia Journalism Review, which obviously I was very naive at that time. I had great respect for it, so I was impressed when they said they wanted to publish it. And I handed over, and then I'm waiting. Issues of the review come out, and they don't contain my article. And I'm about to graduate, so finally I contact the managing editor, Michael Hoyt, at the time. And I say, yay, what's happening to my article? When is it going to be published? And then he tells me that it's not going to be published. And then I say, you know, why? You approached me and you're very enthusiastic. And he says there was a vote, basically, and two voted to support publishing, two opposed. The decisive negative vote was from the executive editor. And I said, what was the reason? And he said, there was a thought that these things happened a long time ago. So then I say, well, how do you study history without going back a long time ago. But this is the most, here's the most disturbing part. When I say, okay, I want my paper back. And he says, why do you want it back? And that red light just lit up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I say, why would you ask me that? It's my paper, so I want it back. And he says, well, it's not the same as what you gave us. And I said, that's precisely why I want it back then. And I went straight to his office and I recovered the galley. They had it in galley form already.
Wow.
Edited, ready for publication. And then I was really perplexed. What is going on, right? I'm still very naive at that time. So I grabbed the paper from him. I walk out. Even before I enter the elevator, I start reading it. And here's one part, actually, that I would like to read from the paper itself. This is something that the editors at the Review inserted into the paper on my behalf without my knowledge or permission before they decided to. First, they censored themselves, then they decided to to not publish. And this is what they wrote. Quote, recently, the Times granted me access to its archives, including correspondences from the 1950s, when the paper sent Bigart to Africa on a temporary assignment. After studying the archival material, I interviewed several present and former Times reporters. The following excerpts from the material and from lengthy interviews are not intended as an indictment of the Times, whose African coverage has occasionally been distinguished, but as a means of highlighting a problem that all news organizations need to address. You know, so I caught them. Mm-hmm. I caught them red-handed. They were afraid of the New York Times. You know, I did them a favor. I sent a copy of the paper to the publisher of the Times. At that time, I think it was Arthur Ox Sulzberger. And the managing editor of the Times, his name was Joseph Littleville, wrote to me and acknowledged the ugly material that I had discovered. And he also made the point that while he was at the Times as a reporter, he tried to push back, you know, against that, which actually, looking at his own files in the archives, happened to have been true. I offered to write an op-ed, putting things in perspective, suggesting where they might go. That offer was declined. When the book was published last year, I have a friend who writes books reviews for the New York Times, so he gave me a specific name to send the book to. I was very skeptical, but he encouraged me to do so. I did. Obviously, there was no response. I was not surprised. You know, the New York Times did a long article in December 2020 after Kansas City Star did a long apology for how it used to cover African-American citizens of Kansas. And the Times did an article about it. So in September and then again in April of this year, I sent a letter to the publisher of the Times. And I said, since you wrote an article about the Kansas City Star, and since you do actually have this specific history with respect to Africa, I think you should do the right thing and also apologize. And I have not gotten a response. Maybe he's still reading the book. I have no idea. So that's where we are.
Well, sorry, unless you were responding to that, Matt, I was hoping before we get to some of the stuff in this text, because like the revelations are quite striking. But in the introduction, you bring up Gaddafi and the Libya NATO operation. And I think that's like a very important place for our audience to maybe start, because I think even amongst, you know, kind of well-meaning leftists, I don't think a lot of them get what that moment in history was.
Right.
I just remember because I was in high school when all that was going on, and the media portrayal you're getting is like the most kind of fantastical, you know, almost fantasy movie of like the perfect dictator, you right. know, and all the people are rising up against him. But right. that's not really the full story, right?
No, it's not. It's part of the story. I mean, obviously, no one can deny that Gaddafi was in office for a very long time. And when you stay for a very long time, you open excuses up to your enemies, internal as well as external. And of course, Gaddafi's biggest crime is, you know, people that follow closely understand is that his position... his stance toward the West.
Mm-hmm.
He became an enemy, really, when he nationalized the oil industry in Libya. When he seized power, he was only in his 20s, actually. And he was never forgiven for that. And he was one of the biggest supporters of the formation of OPEC. Mm-hmm. And as you know, the price of oil, you know, went up dramatically. And for the countries that control it, the ability to retain the revenue just exploded, you know, by 10 times or even more. And what is different between Gaddafi and the other leaders that stayed a long time in power in African countries was that he actually put the money back into the country in Libya, and also put a lot of the money in other African countries. In fact, I remember watching a CNN piece. They were interviewing a Libyan from the from Benghazi. And Benghazi is a very different type of Libya, because Benghazi was the seat of the monarchy, you see? So historically, they always, you know, were opposed to Gaddafi. So they asked a lady there, and they said, why are you celebrating? At that time, he was still in power, but they were now we can call them bandits now, because it's proven that they've turned out to be bandits. Were being supported massively by the West, and they were making significant gains. So they asked the lady, and she said, I'm very happy about this development because Gaddafi was giving too much of our money to Africa. In other words, you know, she didn't even see herself as a part of Africa. And that's what also set Gaddafi apart from the rest of the leaders in North African countries. He resembled more like Gamal Abdel Nasser of the Egypt of the 1950s and 60s, who identified with pan-Arabism, but also pan-African, with a big support of the liberation struggle in African countries. So Gaddafi sort of continued that mantle. And then, of course, when the Arab Spring started in Tunisia, and the West saw that as an opportunity to intervene in Libya. And this was not an authentic uprising. Not to say that Gaddafi did not have many dissenters mm-hmm. within the country. But if any dissent was going to, you know, germinate into something wider, we will never get to know. Because this was clearly a NATO and US war against Libya. And as I discussed in the introduction of the book, there were disturbing elements that did not fit the narrative. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when they started attacking Libyans that looked like me, complected, that was a very inconvenient narrative. Because at that time, the New York Times kept referring to these folks as revolutionists. Mm-hmm. They never really elaborated on their definition of what a revolutionist is, right? But they were actually killing, specifically targeting Libyans that look like me, or Africans from other parts of the continent, migrant workers, you know, that look like me as well, for killing, beheading, and posting these ugly videos on YouTube. And then there was a town in Libya called Tawaga. And I've seen it spelled three different ways. One spelling is T-A-W-E-R-G-A. Another spelling, there's a H after the G. So it's Tawaga, G-H-A. Anyway, that city was populated primarily by Libyans that looked like me. Mm-hmm. The city was ethnically targeted. People were killed. It was ethnically cleansed. Everybody was forced to leave. So either killed or they fled. And on the buildings, they would scrawl words such as brigade to purge slaves from Libya. And the New York Times, to its shame, never covered this story at the time it was happening. CNN never did, the BBC never did, the Guardian, because they were all on the same regime change page. They were in concert with the governments in these Western countries. Mm-hmm. To its credit, of all the papers, check this out. It was the Wall Street Journal that covered these atrocities on a consistent basis. And anybody who is listening and wants to look at the articles, the reporter's name is Sam Dagher. I think the last name is spelled D-A-G-H-A-R. And he did many brilliant articles about these atrocities when they were still ongoing. Mm-hmm. We at Black Star News wrote many editorials, of course, condemning the war, condemning the fact that the ethnic cleansing and targeting was being ignored because it was an inconvenient narrative. Finally, one time we wrote an editorial urging people to call the New York Times, and we gave the phone number and demand that they cover this ethnic cleansing. We gave the number for the White House, for the NAACP, and for the National Urban League. The next day after we had posted that editorial, we could not access our website. I did not make any association with it initially, because why would you, right? So I contacted our host, Network Solutions, and I was told there's a technical issue they're dealing with. So I said, fine. The second day, we still cannot access our website. Then going on the third day, something just told me something is wrong. And I don't know why something told me something is wrong. But I woke up at like maybe 4 a.m., very early. And I called Network Solutions. And the same thing, technical thing. I said, I don't believe you. You guys host thousands and thousands of websites. Are you telling me that you have other websites that are not able to access their website for over 2 days in a row, going on 3 days? I don't believe that. Give me your name. So I spoke to two or three different people, and I took down everybody's name that time. I go back to bed. I wake up hours later. The website is back up. Mm. Wait a minute. So what's going on? And then I look and I see that that editorial had been deleted from the website. I said, wow. So now I make the association. It's completely deleted. Luckily, many other websites had published the same editorial. So we wrote another editorial saying there's an editorial that the folks, the powers that be, don't want you to read. And we explained what had happened, how our website had, we had not had access for days. And after we gain access, this editorial is gone. And here is the editorial. So we linked to other websites that was carrying our editorial before we sort of rewrote it again and published it as well. I spoke to a lawyer at that time. And, you know, the lawyer told me, he said, listen, yes, you know, you could file a lawsuit. But then, of course, they would say, how have you been damaged, really? I mean, they should restore your site and, you know, how have you been damaged, number one. Number two, politically, it would not really be a very popular lawsuit right now. I'm just being frank with you, but if you want to do it, you know, we can still go ahead. So, you know, we did not pursue it. But up today, I have to admit, I would still like to know how it works. For sure. Does somebody from a U.S. government agency pick up the phone and speak to the CEO of Network Solutions? And then what kind of conversation? It's amazing.
You got to think they probably just say something about national security. Oh, yeah, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And what is the national security? To urge people to call these entities I just mentioned and ask them, why are they not saying anything about the ethnic cleansing?
Yeah.
So obviously they thought that once this became widely known, it would be inconvenient to the regime change agenda. So in that respect, you're right. They would invoke national security. Yep. The reasons, I think people deserve to know that. And maybe that's one of the reasons why, you know, I mean, I got the book was reviewed by Kirkus Review. And people say, you know, that's as close as you'll get to a quote unquote corporate entity review. I was not surprised, as I said, that the New York Times, you know, never mentioned it. At least when I wrote to the publisher when I was still a student at Columbia, the managing editor wrote back at that time. But now that it's in a form of a book, there seems to be reluctance to acknowledge it or to even communicate back.
Yeah, I mean, that seems really antithetical to the truth for a news organization to be doing something like that. And, you know, yeah, it's like, if it's so long ago, then we should be able to be honest about it.
Precisely, precisely. And going back to the point you just made, if we are supporting the notion that all the symbolisms that supported slavery, enslavement, colonialism, and all those symbols and signs are now coming down, the history is being viewed much more critically, why should you, a media outlet, be immune from that self-reflection, particularly when you did an article about the Kansas City Star? So, I mean, you know, they owe an answer, I think, at the very least.
Yeah. And, you know, this is something that I think people need to, because we are inundated with messages of, you know, the Washington Post, we're saviors of democracy. And there's a dark side to the press, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, America, a lot of early newspapers were funded in part by classifieds to recapture escaped slaves.
Absolutely.
Right. Like that, like this, it's impossible. And then like just the rampant, like the 19th century press and the way it described crime and that sort of stuff. Like it's really, we really need to account for that sort of stuff. And could you just illustrate the press as foundational to like building apartheid in Africa, for instance?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, even before apartheid was official policy in South Africa, some of the earliest articles in the New York Times that I discovered were from the 1920s, when they were basically serving as mouthpieces for the European establishment, which had, you know, seized power, had not yet officially made apartheid the official policy legally, because that did not happen until 1948. But more than two decades before that, they're already pulling all these policies in practice. So you would find the reporter in the New York Times article saying that the Europeans explain that the system of European civilization is too sophisticated for Africans. So the native, as they were referred, had to be transitioned slowly over a period, gradually. And they kept using this reference in multiple articles. If you Google New York Times, Africa, natives, and monkey and razor blade, and let me explain why. So the reporter said she was told that giving Africans that same level of civilization would be like giving a razor blade to a monkey. And I don't understand the meaning or reference at all, but I found that in multiple references and stories. And basically it was an apologia for the construction of the apartheid state. And this was also reflected in the Portuguese colonies, where the reporter went and interviewed the colonial Portuguese governor in Mozambique. And the same story that another set of Europeans in South Africa from different European background was basically articulating the same concept, that in here in Mozambique, we want to also bring the natives to our standard of civilization. You know, people are talking about vote, you know, how can these people vote? These people, you know, their ancestors were cannibals, you know, who do they vote for, you know? And what is so interesting is that these views are being just published without the reporter actually being critical, or perhaps asking some of these Africans, you know, well, what is your reaction to what this governor is saying? So that's why in that particular chapter, I headlined it, the New York Times as apologists for apartheid.
Mayur.
Gotcha. Do you know, Milton, I even saw this as picking up currency in Europe, where leaders like Macron will complain about wokeness. Do you view that, like I do, as basically just complaints about this stuff being talked about?
Okay, I didn't hear the question. Go ahead. Sorry.
I even see the complaints about wokeness coming from Emmanuel Macron.
Right.
Do you view that as just people being upset, elites being upset that this sort of stuff is being talked about?
Well, you know, it's difficult. I think once you, the cheapest way, of course, is to deny that, you know, there was any bad history. And obviously the overarching fear is that once you start accepting, acknowledging, then you have to do something about it, right? Not only do you have to, you know, verbally address it, but you have to start rectifying some of the damages done from historical exploitation and subjugation. So a lot of people that are critical are people that are too aware of history and educated to believe that, you know, they don't believe that something needs to be done, right? But the cheapest way is just to ridicule people that are saying, let's not only reexamine the narrative and the history, but let's do something about it to address the contemporary issues and contemporary challenges. Because a lot of people know one basic fact, that a lot of African countries are impoverished, not only for historical exploitation, but for contemporary exploitation. Even though African countries now have African presidents and prime ministers, the structural colonial economy that was created has never changed. So colonialism continues, only this time in blackface. So let me give you a very simple example. When the Europeans colonized Africa, formally, they had a conference, the Berlin Conference, from November 1884 to February 1885. Because the Europeans had already started getting into some hostilities as they were scrambling for Africa. So they said, listen, we're going to have, you know, a major European war on the African continent. To avoid that, Otto von Bismarck hosted the Berlin Conference. Britain, you get this. France, you get this. Belgium, you get this. Spain, you get this. Germany, you get this. Italy, you get this. You know, so let's do it, you know, without having to fight amongst ourselves. So they did that. And what did they set up? So because Europe had mostly just industrialized or was still industrializing, so they set up zones of exclusivity. So the British had their zone of exclusivity from where to mine primary resources for their factories, where to control, subjugate cheap labor on the farmlands, displacing people from their land, and in the mines, right? And they had a captive market for the manufactured produce. So Africans would grow cotton, you know, literally sell it for nothing to the Europeans, who would take it back to their factories, turn it into textiles and clothing, bring it back to the same Africans who are underpaid, force them to buy at a greatly inflated cost. That was what was set up. Independence, or so-called independence, mostly in the 1960s, you had African presidents, prime ministers, but that same setup never changed. So today in the 21st century, Africans still export what they call raw materials or primary materials. Africa is the only continent. It's not yet industrialized, you know? So they sell the same stuff, the same basket of goods and more, you know, goods, because now you have new resources that have been discovered over the years. But they sell them unprocessed, unrefined, without taking it through the factory, in lump sum, very cheaply to Europe, and now increasingly to China as well. And it is brought back as manufactured at greatly inflated prices. But you won't have any incentive for the many, many journalists who write about Africa to examine this paradigm, right? Because they're so busy looking at, you know, backward Africa, you know, savage Africa, uncivilized Africa, without saying, let's look at the elements that is really keeping the continent where it is today. So even the so-called enlightened, the one so-called friends of Africa, who don't consider themselves to be prejudiced or racist, if they are not inclined to look at that perspective, they too are of no use. They, you know, pretty much are the same as the ones that are totally hostile toward Africa.
Yeah, and you talk about the African tyrant motif, and it is like a great shame that like I mean, that came out right when I was in college, you know, just turning on to how to understand the world. And you get this giant sort of campaign of look at this warlord. Right. And it's and donate to this NGO. Right. I mean, there's a horrible that is a horrible like message about a continent.
Right. No, it is. And sadly, it works both ways. Right. Because when you're used to let's take the term before I even go to that, let's take the term tribe or tribal, for example. Obviously, when Africans use the term tribe, they use it in a very different way, trying to distinguish what particular part of the country they come from, distinguishing themselves from Yoruba as opposed to Igbo, Kikuyu as opposed to Luo, and so on and so forth. But when it's used in the European historical context of demonization, it is to signify people that are still at a lesser form of evolution or civilization. So I say that to suggest that sometimes when you have conflicts in African countries, when publications, newspapers refer to them as tribal, then nobody is interested in digging any deeper. So, oh yeah, yeah, it's another tribal thing. We understand. Basically, people just wake up in Africa in a tribal mood sometimes, and they go at each other, right? And so that also explains the whole dictator concept. So let's look at a Mobutu, for example. Mobutu was a favored dictator of the United States. So in terms of people who are not in the know, as far as the word they regard Mobutu, this is just another African, you know, dictator. They're all over the place. Without realizing that, Mobutu was an agent of the CIA. There's a very good book out by Susan Williams, the CIA, White Malice, the CIA and the covert recolonization of Africa. It's a brilliant book. And it has a lot of details and documentation and discusses that Mobutu actually was a CIA agent since 1958, 2 years before Congo won its independence. So then, of course, Congo wins its independence and it has this nationalist Pan-African Prime Minister, Patrice Lumumba, whose mentor is Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, who is calling for African unity, a United States of Africa. It's the only way the continent can protect its, you know, resources, you know. So Mobutu, of course, then becomes the tool that the West used to eliminate, to liquidate Patrice Lumumba. And he's referred to as, you know, this dictator without any elaboration, right? That this is actually, quote unquote, our man, financed and installed in power by the United States, maintained in power by the United States for 37 years. Whenever the Congolese tried to have an uprising, a revolution, the U.S., they sent the U.S. planes, Moroccan troops would land and they would crush any uprising. But, you know, as far as the most of the outside world is concerned, this is an African problem because mm-hmm. they have an African dictator, something which is very natural and inherent to African countries. And then, of course, they can use that the other way around as well. When they want to liquidate Kwame Nkrumah, then they also say, well, this is an African dictator who's suppressing the opposition. And they celebrate and welcome the new leaders when the armed forces take over power in 1966, for example. But then if you read Susan Williams' book, and even before I read the book, there's a website, and now I forget the exact link, but people can Google it. If you look at the, if you put like State Department, you know, historical archives, I think it will give you the exact link. And you'll go there and all these correspondences from all over the world where the U.S. has diplomatic presence. And I had already read many of the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Accra. And coming from here, going to the embassy as well, when the U.S. Clearly conspiring with the leaders of the armed forces and the police to overthrow Nkrumah's government in the 1960s by using various means. There's one cable said they should use the press to generate hostility and hatred toward Nkrumah by the population. There was one that said the World Bank had approved a loan for the Volta River project, which created this huge electricity project in Ghana, which the country, up to date actually benefits tremendously from. So that there was a suggestion that the State Department should intervene and tell the World Bank to delay disbursing the monies in order to make the economy unstable and to make it much more likely that Nkrumah would get, overthrown. It's just amazing. And then there was another cable, I forget the names of, all the generals now that immediately overthrew him. But when he came, he was invited immediately to the White House. And he came to the White House and he said, he doesn't understand why the U.S. is not using nuclear weapons against the Vietnamese. This war could have been ended a long time ago. So these are the kind of reactionaries that they installed in power after they liquidated Nkrumah. So I'd been reading a lot of that, but Susan Williams' book just puts all of this together. So they use the dictator to absolve themselves of responsibility or liability when Mobutu is destroying the country, and they also use it to eliminate somebody who is actually a genuine threat ideologically.
Man, I mean, I almost see parallels in how Boris Johnson and Trump operate in America, but but that's fascinating. I mean, I can't recommend the book enough. People can get it, unless you add something more, David, at Kendall Hunt Publishing, he.kendallhunt.com, Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media. Milton, thanks so much, and thanks for the book.
I'm very grateful for you guys. I'm glad to get an opportunity to talk about this. And if I do get a response from the publisher of the New York Times, I will update you and let you know.
Yes, please.
Come on, New York Times.
I'm not holding my breath.
Hey, always time to make good, New York Times. So let's start the process. All right.